If your brand belongs in the heart of the yachting world, this is where it happens. Yachting International Radio reaches over 1 million yachting professionals and enthusiasts every month, with 77 million impressions, 220,000 social followers, and 74,000 podcast subscribers. Our hosts are insiders, crew, captains, CEOs, trusted voices shaping the industry. This is targeted, high-impact advertising in a luxury niche. Visit yachtinginternationalradio.com/advertise. Your audience is already listening.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Bridge. I'm your host, Alex Seegers. I'm joined today by my friend, Yatral, from The Yachting Investor. Yatral, I'd like to introduce yourself and give a little bit more background on stuff you did.
Hey there. Thanks for having me, dude. Good to see you again. Hi, everyone. I'm Sean. I'm from South Africa. I am a first mate on a charter yacht. I've been in the industry for 7 years now. And about a year ago, I started a venture called The Yachting Investor, where I aim to help crew with financial education and to help democratize financial literacy so that our healthy paychecks gets deployed in the right manner.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I know I was on your podcast earlier this year. We talked more about of the cycle of overspending and partying and whatnot in the yachting industry. How can yacht crew members and people in our industry kind of play up the lack in the yachting, but know and have the resources to make sure they're financially set and they're not just wasting their time whenever 5-10 years is spent in the industry?
It's a really good question, and kind of the whole genesis of this whole venture that I've taken on. So firstly, in order to build a plan, you got to kind of know what's going on in your financial well-being at this very moment. And I think what happens is, because we get thrown into a world of high earnings and low expenses, everyone automatically just assumes, I don't need to budget. I'm going to have free cash flow at the end of the month because my rent and my groceries, and in some nationalities, our taxes are taken care of. However, lifestyle creep happens very quickly. And before you know it, that every afternoon drinks and snacks, aperitivos in the med, or the constant Amazon expenses, they really add up. And before you know it, you're actually living paycheck to paycheck. And if you return back to land and you incur real land expenses, you are going to kick yourself if you didn't put a nest egg away. So what I frequently tell yachties that come to me for coaching session or any form of pointers, what I normally tell them first is go pull a month's worth of bank statements, go look at where your money goes to, and then dissect whether certain of those things really mean a lot to you and certain of those things you can really do without. And what that exercise will teach you is it will help prioritize things that you do attach value to. So you and me, for example, you and I both like the outdoors. We like going on adventures. I will never want to starve myself from going on those adventures. But I'm also very wary of the fact that I don't like fancy dinners or wearing designer clothes. So I cut on those departments. You cannot have it all. So the earlier you decide on what gives you joy, what brings you happiness, focus on those things and spend extravagantly on that, but cut mercilessly on the shit that you don't care about.
Yeah, I think that's an extremely important topic. And I find myself too, is like, I just came off a charter boat and I was making bank. And then I see myself coming here and I'm looking at all these different like adventure gear and stuff like that. And I'm just like, ooh, I could easily drop 200 euros on that right now. But you need to have that like solidarity where you look at it and it's like, do I really need to be making this purchase right now? I can put it into something that would run me further down the line. So like, for me, it's my business. For you, your portfolio. And once my actions are making money again, it will be my portfolio as well. What can you see as like juggling the lifestyle where people kind of miss the mark on really what yachting can entail? Because I can say, I'm speaking to you and on you more and my own experiences, people don't really take full advantage of the opportunities yachting gives you. For example, people go spend hundreds of dollars on dinners and drinks and the night out, but then they'll miss the opportunity of maybe going on a hike or getting more immersed in the culture or seeing amazing things that you wouldn't be able to see back home. So how do you find juggling those decisions and what makes you more committed to making the right ones, but it kind of lets you live the life that you wanted to live, take full advantage of those experiences.
Well, look, I don't think everyone is naturally wired to identify that early. I definitely fell in the trap in the first 2 years of yachting. You know, I was sent from a small town in South Africa and I moved to Palma, and suddenly everyone you know that lives in the crew houses around you is going for drinks or going to beach clubs or going clubbing in the evenings. And, you know, at 22, 23, you're like, fuck it, YOLO, I'm doing it. And in all honesty, you should get that out of your system. But at some point, I'm turning 30 in a few months. Like, at some point, you're like, I may be too old now to be hanging out in these beach clubs. You know, you're going to become that guy. And there's just a lot more wholesome. And look at this, you got to look objectively. You and I like the outdoors, like I mentioned, but certain people, their relaxation comes from a day ordering a Magnum bottle of rosé next to a swimming pool at a beach club in Ibiza. And we can't judge that, you know, it's like, and they would find it exhausting if they see what you and I do on a day off when we go trek a mountain. They're like, what the fuck do you mean that's your idea of relaxation? So it's very important to identify once again, like what you value, what you enjoy, but just not catching yourself in that whole yachty loop of, you know what it's like. It's always around alcohol, and I like cracking open a cold one as much as the next guy. But if you're not prioritizing rest, your mental health, just switching away and doing a bit more healthier things, you're suddenly being caught in that yachty death spiral of working 14, 16 hour days all season and then going on 3-4 day benders on during your periods of downtime. And before you know it, you're 30 years old, you're halfway to being an alcoholic, and you have nothing to show for all your years working at sea.
Yeah, I was actually speaking to somebody earlier today, and he was talking about the health implications that come with that lifestyle as well. Once you're pushing so hard on charters and you're working all these days, and then right afterwards you go on a 3-4 day bender, that's just extremely detrimental to your health. And then you'll find yourself approaching 30, I'm 28, I'm already feeling it physically. And then you won't have any sort of financial backing or financial ground to rely on to take some time off and see what else you could do outside of being lightning space. And it's very concerning for me, but I like seeing, because now it's a digital age and getting more connected with different entrepreneurs in the yachting industry. Yeah. We see how people are coming together and saying, hey, these resources are not available. And they're taking, people like you are taking the action to bring that to life. And so how can you describe, I know you're still working full time as a mate on charter, but how can you juggle these two full-time jobs, basically?
I mean, it's not ideal. It's not easy. One advantage is not being very sleep dependent, to be honest. That might catch up one day, but sleeping, and this is not a recommendation to anybody. It's just kind of worked in my favor to be able to function on a short nights of sleep when you have to put in the long nights after a charter shift to work on the business. But the other thing is, since I've kind of scaled down the like partying lifestyle, quite amazing how much time frees up in your downtime. And yes, we work a lot of hours, but there's also frequent periods where we don't have guests on and you're down to 8 or 9 hour days. And then it's really important to be able to, when you pack up your washdown locker at 4 or 4:30, to be able to go straight into the next phase of work if it's important to you. It's quite one of my pet peeves to hear people say, I don't have time for that, or I don't have time to implement this idea. You're like, you're talking utter shit. You're just not prioritizing what's important to you. And if you don't have something that lights your fire, I think you and I have now both found ventures where I'm like, I'm really excited at the end of a yachty workday to jump into what I'm busy building here. And that really helps, because before you know it, you've started work, your second phase of work at 5 p.m. and you look on your watch and you're like, holy shit, it's midnight. It's time to go to bed. And you've put in a 7-6 hour stint. Now, it comes with sacrifice, and I'm still trying to strike the perfect balance. Luckily, I've got an amazing, supportive fiance that is understanding that we're busy building something for our futures one day. But it's also very important now and then, especially when you reach the wall, just like when you're on a long hike and you're suddenly completely depleted of all your nutrients and electrolytes, you need to know when to stop. We need to go sit in the shade, go eat one of your gels, recoup. The same goes for building these businesses. I found myself some nights doing a very menial task that's taking way too long. And that's purely because the brain needs to switch off and then shut down the laptop, pull out Uno or light the Barbie or do anything that doesn't involve working. So don't have the answer for you yet, but I think we'll strike the balance soon.
Yeah, I believe it as well. I think as you spend more time with this and as you get deeper into these ventures, and the first part of it is always just this bum rush of complete dedication, complete sacrifice to completing this task and not even really knowing if it's going to pay fruition. But then you get to a certain point where you're like, okay, I've kind of got a better handle on this. You can see what's really important, the bigger tasks that need to be taken care of and not getting lost in the weeds of things. The weeds of things and the details are extremely important. But then you also need to understand that you're just a human. Like I find myself personally on this struggle. Like, I mean, I was working the days and then at night I was catching up on emails, on meetings. And so the chief engineer would come in and he'd see me on phone calls at like 11 o'clock at night. I'm supposed to be sleeping for my morning shift. But it just takes that sort of dedication. And then once you get the downtime, like I have this downtime here in Palma, I'm still taking care of all of my business, but also realizing that I need to take the time for yourself, because there's always going to be that work to do, but you're going to hit a wall and you're going to get burnt out even more, and you're not going to be able to operate it in fullest capacity and serve the people that you know you've been working so hard to serve.
Yeah, you're right. And another thing on that, what I found since I started this, at some point in your yachting career, you realize you're sacrificing so much for, you know, other people. And yes, okay, these other people, our employers, they pay us a fair amount of money. It's not like we're held there against our will. But after your fifth or sixth Christmas, Thanksgiving, birthday, funerals, weddings, all of the things that you sacrifice, it really starts eating at you. And you start having, at least it happened to me, I started having a bit of like an existential crisis of like, okay, what is all of this for? And the moment I found another venture to focus on, it kind of started distracting my mind from all that. And I started viewing yachting in a different lens of like, oh, okay, I'm doing this in order to feed my next chapter and my next venture. And that's made all the difference, because now when I'm back at work, I'm like washing the boat for the 700th time. And you're like, okay, actually, there's a reason for this, because today I'm going to grab a healthy paycheck at the end of this month. And then that goes straight into the business and the second chapter. So reframing sometimes and taking a step back is really important.
Yeah. And seeing really what it is that you're doing this for. I have the exact same thing. And last year, missing parents' birthdays, family's birthdays, holidays, Christmas, New Year's, everything. I'm just thinking, it's like, it's been 5-6 years since I've been able to spend those holidays with families. Like, what are we doing here? What are we using yachting to do? Yachting is an extremely amazing industry to be a part of, but it gets to a point, I think, for every single crew member where you're asking that question. It's like, okay, what am I doing in the long term? What are the things I want in my life? Do I want to have a wife? Do I want to have kids? How often do I want to see my kids? And so then it really lights the spark where you have to spend that time and take what you've earned, which is why I think what you're doing is so important, giving people the resources and education of how to appropriately spend their money. So like, I saved the majority of my money, like 85% over the last 2 years, so I could take time to really sit there with the ideas and say, okay, what am I going to be doing in nurturing that and being able to take 4 or 5 months off and just spend it directly on leading the staffs? And so can you go into more detail of how people can better save their money or use it to allow a foundation for them to grow once they start getting those inklings in the back of their mind that, hey, they could be one now. Have a day off on their birthday and celebrate it with friends and family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really good question. So look, there's not a one size fits all recommendation. You know, all of us have different backgrounds, have different duties and responsibilities. Certain yacht crew already sitting with a mortgage or two and a wife and kids back home. But for the most part, most of our audience today will be younger cohort of yacht crew. And a very important thing to understand is our biggest thing that we have on our side is not just the free cash flow, but it's time. And if you have time, you can allow your investments to compound more. And to be a bit more specific on that, it's no longer in this inflationary environment okay for people to just save. You can't keep your money in a check account or even in a savings account in first world countries and expect that you are going to keep pace with inflation. Unfortunately, with the way the world economy is structured, and especially the US is structured, they print money out of thin air. There's so much debt going around in all countries, and because everyone can print money with no repercussions, it means your dollar today is worth way less than your dollar tomorrow. So if you don't get your money invested into income generating assets like stock market investments or property or crypto for those with a higher risk appetite, if you're not getting your money working in alternative assets, your cash is burning away. To give people a scary example, the US money supply has grown by 30% since 2020. So since 2020, it took 100 years for the US to reach that point, and then only 5 years for the money supply to expand by 30% more, which tells you your dollars from 2020, if you had $100 in 2020, that is worth $70 now. So if people start framing it that way, and it's not just about the zeros you see in your bank account, but it's about what is the opportunity cost of keeping this money today as opposed to getting it invested in something like the stock market. So to be a bit more specific, let's start with the stock market. So what I recommend to 99% of retail stock market investors, people like you and I that aren't part of an institution, is to buy something called a low-cost index fund. And that's a very fancy word and a blanket name for any product that follows an index. So I'll use the S&P 500 today as an example. The S&P 500 is an index of the 500 largest stocks in the USA. And by the USA, basically the world, because all the biggest companies are jurisdiction is in the USA. So why I like this as particular investment instrument, instead of you going to have to do the research to buy 500 separate individual stocks, analyze each of these companies' performance, look at their earnings reports, look at what AI is doing to their business, you now buy one instrument, which is called an ETF, an exchange-traded fund, that buys a tiny piece of all of these 500 businesses. And the analogy I like to use to people, if you imagine an apartment building with 500 apartments inside, instead of buying one of those apartments and running the risk of that apartment catching on fire, or there's a flood, or someone breaking in, you now buy a tiny piece of all 500 companies, which diversifies your risks. And it gives people like you and I the opportunity to own a small piece of 500 cash generating businesses. And on average, over the past 100 years, the S&P 500 has returned anything between 8 to 10%. Now, just side note, everybody, 8 to 10% has been the historical past. Past performance is not indicative of future returns. So it might happen that the next 10 years is a total fucking train smash, like after 2008's financial crisis. So then you don't come at me and say, oh, Charles said we have to invest in the S&P 500. It can happen. All investing carries risk. But on average, if you can expect 8 to 10%, it's not ginormous numbers. But that's where I bring back to my original point is time. Because we have time and we have a long runway, a bunch of decades for this money to compound, 8 to 10% year over year will blow your brain. And I urge all the listeners to quickly pause this podcast, go Google something called compound interest calculator and just put generic amounts like $1,000 per month with an 8% expected return. And then all you have to change on each calculation is the timeline. So change it from 5 to 10 to 15 to 20 to 25. After year 10, 15, the compounding starts doing its magic and your returns are no longer linear, but they start becoming exponential. And then you'll realize the more money you put aside in your 20s, 30s, even 40s, by the time you are 50, you are going to be filthy fucking rich without having to try. And that is a guarantee.
Yeah, it's not exactly. I've played with that for a bit in these last couple of years, index funds and then investing in, you know, technologies, because, you know, when to software and AI, so I invested heavily into that, and you're just seeing the crazy returns year after year. And then, of course, yeah, you never know what he's going to do, especially in this current political climate. We don't know what the hell is going to be like in the next 2 years. All right. One thing that a question that popped up as you were saying that is, how can crew that are coming from different countries and whatnot, how are they able to set up accounts where they can invest inside the United States stock market?
It's a very good question. So each country has different compliance restrictions. Me as a South African with a South African passport, unbelievably difficult. It took me about a year and a half to finally found a reliable online brokerage platform. Traditional finance wants you to go with a financial advisor. And this is where my business is causing a lot of uproar, and I'm getting a lot of hate mail from traditional financial advisors. I have some, I don't really care, because they want you to struggle to do it yourself so that you pay them a ridiculous fee to do it for you. Now, I've made it one of my life's missions to make all, at least for now in the yachting sphere, to make all of the main nationalities to give them very solid info on how to start. So I've written a bunch of newsletters, which I'm happy to send you to put in the show notes, where I wrote how to invest $100 in the stock market as a beginner by country. And then I go through the US yachties, the Aussies, the Brits, the Filipinos, the Safas, the every single cohort that I've ever met in yachting, I've tried to write a deep dive on, and then give you options. Americans, you guys got it pretty easy. You've got Robinhood, you've got Vanguard, you've got, I mean, the list goes on and on for the type of brokerages you can use, and it's extremely low cost. So you can buy the S&P 500 today with a 0.05% interest, or not an interest fee, a management fee, where a traditional financial advisor would charge you 2%, which is more than 100x in fees. So it is a pretty, pretty crazy revolution that happened in the past few years. And now you can buy fractional shares. So anyone from any nationality, one of the biggest themes I see in my coaching calls is they say, okay, well, I'll let you know once I get to $10,000, then I'll start investing. I'm like, what the fuck are you waiting for? Like, you can start investing with $10. And quite frankly, the smaller the amount is, the more you get to exercise those muscles, the less skin you have in the game, so that when there is a drawdown, you don't have like a complete panic attack. You're like, oh, okay, now I see how markets fluctuate, because it's not always going to go up. You're very naive if you think it's always going to go up. You have to deal with drawdowns. But like I mentioned before, 98, 99% of people listening to this, if you can get the majority of your money working in something like a low-cost index fund for the base of your money, and then give yourself like a 10, 20%, I call it my degenerate fund, that goes into things like crypto or the next NVIDIA or something like that, just to kind of feed your inner gambler so you don't feel too conservative. And if that thing hits and it runs, you're like, oh, wow. But also, if it completely bonks and goes to zero, you're fine. You have enough working in a safe, secure asset.
Yeah, that's actually pure fun. You and I have two very different definitions of a degenerate fund. I thought that was going somewhere completely else. What percentage ratio would you recommend for yacht crew on their spending habits when they're a paycheck, and they're breaking it down on what they should invest and what they should keep for fun and experiences, etc.
Okay, so firstly, before I answer any of this, everyone, I'm not a licensed financial advisor. I'm just a super money nerd. Please don't take this as financial advice. I'm purely going to talk out of my own lens and my own opinion and what I do, because it's important to eat your own cooking, right? So what I recommend to people, and this is what I've been doing since day one, is regardless of what position you are on the boat, commit to a percentage that goes to your future self. So me, I decided from day one, 80% of my income is going to go to future Shaul, and I will give myself 20% to play with and to go on fun adventures and to go for drinks and whatever. So as you scale up your income, as you grow through the hierarchy in yachting, your expenditure will be more for your personal life because your 80-20 ratio remains intact. But you're also investing more because the 80% has naturally gotten more. Now, that's a very aggressive approach. And within the 80%, what I did was 50% into the S&P 500, 10% into my emergency fund being a cash reserve I always have that by definition is there for an emergency and when the shit inevitably hits the fan. And then the other 10%, so we're at 50, we're at 10, we're at 60. So then 10% I allocate to crypto, I buy Bitcoin, and the other 10% went to a constant savings account for real estate. And every time I managed to find a new deal in the property market in South Africa, I would slightly adjust what I allocate my other asset classes to, and I would be a bit more aggressive to my real estate fund until I have enough money to put a deposit down on real estate. And what that does is every month I'm inherently diversifying into three or four different asset classes whilst also giving myself enough cash to play with. And I'm super happy I did that when I was 23, 24, because now at 29, it's part of my habits. I don't even think about it. I've had to adjust my ratio slightly because I've now moved land-based and I actually have to pay rent and like we have a dog and more like real life expenses. But all in all, the saving and the investing muscles have been trained for many years now. So when there are months like this month where I'm paying like wedding deposits, where I actually don't have free cash to invest, I actually feel a bit like anxious about it. I'm like, ooh, I didn't contribute everything. And then I'm like, no, Shaul, you're being silly. Let's go look at our portfolio. I'm like, okay, she's looking fine and dandy. She doesn't need to be added to this month. And then from next month, we resume. That's my approach.
That's a very good approach. I'm actually going to take some tips on that for myself in this next coming year. You mentioned something about real estate. Is that something you've come into recently? Have you bought any property? What can you expand on there more? Because I know a lot of people in the yachting space are looking to buy properties, looking to get what they call passive income and create rental properties as we get access to all these places around the world.
Yeah, so that's the most obvious one. And I have a bit of a hot take on real estate that not a lot of people agree with me. But once again, personal finance is personal. So this is just my opinion. In the first world, so countries like the US, the UK, Australia, basically everywhere except for us, real estate has become incredibly unaffordable relative to people's earnings. Now, traditional wisdom, and because of our parents' generation and the boomer generation having so much more affordable access to real estate, they always tell us, you can't go wrong with real estate. Real estate always goes up. It no longer is the case. I really believe that real estate, buying a house for your primary home, is not a wise financial decision. You are way better off renting in the first world. Now, when real estate purchases do make sense, in my opinion, once again, is when someone else is paying off that mortgage. And in South Africa, it's slightly different in terms of affordability, especially us earning foreign income and purchasing in a much weaker currency. So I try every year to buy at least one rental property, because in South Africa, you need like 10 grand US to put a deposit down on a house and you're good to go. That's a charter season steps, half a charter season.
That's easy in yachting, $10,000 for a deposit. Shit, I should.
You know, where in the US, you're looking at $100,000 just to get your toes dipped into the market and to get a reasonable interest rate. So what I've been doing is I've kind of built my own little model on how to analyze properties back in South Africa. I do some back of the envelope calculations. And if I see that this property will be cash flow positive from day one, cash flow positive means after I pay the municipal rates and the HOA fees and the mortgage installment and the insurance, the tenant's rent will cover that expenses. It means the place is cash flow positive. So effectively, I'm only putting a $10,000 deposit on for a $100,000 or $200,000 asset that someone else is paying off. And that's why I like real estate. It lacks flexibility and it lacks liquidity. I can't just quickly sell my house if I lose my job, but you can use leverage. So I can use the bank's money to buy an asset and use someone else's money to pay off the asset. And then after 10 or 15 years, I own a house that I only paid $10,000 for. So that's why I love real estate. And I'm actually building a very thorough property course for now, specifically focusing on South African yacht crew and teaching them how to buy property without being a fool. Because it took me the first two times I completely fucked it up. I bought disastrous properties. And they caused me a lot of pain, and I learned a lot of very expensive lessons with lawyers and with transfer attorneys and things like that. And now I'm putting all of this knowledge into a course, and then people can use this self-paced, mobile-friendly. And whenever you think you're ready to pull the trigger, get yourself educated. You'll save yourself a few $10,000 by just doing the due diligence up front. And then you also have a stable asset so that if the US dollar or any form of fiat currency implodes, you actually have a roof over your head and can be like, okay, government, you can't take this from me. Hopefully. Yeah,
this is mine. And so kind of, I've heard this thing is like you have a bunch of rental properties and whatnot. Just basically the accumulation of all that asset, those costs, you get access to basically the network of it, and you can borrow and get funds against those properties. Is that correct? Is that something you utilize?
Very true. So there's a few nice things. I'm yet to purchase property in the US, so I don't want to speak for how it works in the US. But in South Africa, at least, you can get something called a flexi bond. So that basically means an access mortgage. So all the money that goes into my mortgage, that account, it's not locked in there. It remains, you can use it as a checking account if you want. So you can pull money out of there to put deposits on the next properties, which is really cool. And that's the way I've been doing it. But if you're looking at scaling anything, if you need let's say I want a business loan of $100,000 to take the next step in the yachting investor, I can put my properties down as collateral. I can borrow against that property. And because that thing is a loan, you can't get taxed on it because there's no tax on loans. It's a whole different ballgame if you're just using your own capital, because they're going to ask you, where's that capital coming from? And then they want to tax capital gains tax on that capital. So that's how the rich of the rich, people like Elon, people like Jeff Bezos, they just borrow against their stock or their properties, or even the property that their businesses function in, they borrow money against that to take the next step in their business. And then that way you never get taxed. Now, once again, everyone, I'm not a tax specialist. I'm not telling you to be to do tax evasion or tax avoidance or anything like that. But the economy is structured in a way where you can be creative. And if you're just accepting the government taking as much as they can from you, you're being a fool. It takes one prompt in ChatGPT to tell you, hey, you can try explore this avenue and then consult a tax professional before you make any big decision like that, please.
Yeah, I think with all the access to information, especially nowadays, and with ChatGPT, you can put together an entire financial planning and model and whatnot, you specifically in 5-10 minutes, and you can have something you can follow for years just based off
that's
the
right.
It's true. What immediately gives you just basically financial advisor advice for free. This right there. I didn't want a problem with AI. I wanted to touch more as I travel around and I see these different boats and whatnot, as people are investing more in cryptocurrency. You mentioned Bitcoin as yourself. Is that the only cryptocurrency that you currently invest in?
No. So if we look at my crypto portfolio as its own bucket, I own about 75% Bitcoin, 15 ETH, 15 Solana, give or take. I really did the diligence. I started buying Bitcoin in 2019. So I've been through some gnarly ups and downs. You know, one morning I woke up and I lost 80% of my Bitcoin holdings, lost in parentheses because I didn't sell. So I didn't realize those losses. But you do need a bit of a stomach of steel within that asset class. More recently, I've learned more about things like Solana and Ethereum, and I've held Ethereum for a long time, which I'm happy about because the last few months have been pretty lucrative. And Solana, I now understand. We were actually very lucky to have a very famous crypto personality podcast host dude. He's chartered our boat like 3 times. Him and I became really close. Kind of helped me to understand what the application is of these layer two technologies on the blockchain and why something like Solana is not just targeting crypto, but it's targeting the financial sector as a whole. Because I don't understand how in this day and age, we can still only do transactions in the stock market from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Monday to Friday, where every single other part of the finance sector is 24/7. And Solana is aiming to get things like the NASDAQ and the S&P, all of this on blockchain so that it can be a 24/7 ledger and a transaction that is probably a lot more accurate than tracking what's going on there. But as for the rest of crypto, to me, it's still a bit of the Wild West. You know, there's every cycle it has, it's new. Like last time it was NFTs. Now it's all these companies issuing debt. And for some people it works, like Michael Saylor from MicroStrategy is an absolute madman. He's made like billions and billions of dollars of moving his company's cash into Bitcoin as a strategic cash reserve. And I don't know, the next few years will be really exciting for all of this. But my personal risk appetite, I only allow my crypto to be about 20% of my total net worth. And every time the prices run up and it starts teetering above the 20% threshold, then I actually sell some crypto. I take some chips off the table and then I buy a car or I put down a wedding deposit or things like that. So I at least feel like I'm getting reward for all of this risk I'm taking in this asset class. How about you?
For me personally, it's XRP. I've been in XRP.
Okay.
For a year and a half now, ups and downs. And for some reason, I'm still just holding on to it. I like it. I like the way it's wanting to move money across borders. I think that's nowadays, you can just change foreign exchanges instantly. I think that would be fantastic with minimal fees on a 24/7 basis, because there's really no reason that money should take this long to move across borders. Yeah. It can take 2-3 days for you to send $10,000 from the United States to Mexico. It should just happen like that in this day and age. And what do you think, as technology continues to advance with what AI is doing, the way AI is shaping up the world, how do you really see these different markets kind of culminating in the next couple of years? I mean, you have a really good strategy and you have all these things, which is amazing, that you can take money off the table and then pay for your wedding, pay for a car, et cetera. I let your investment and all your dedication pay for in your lifestyle when you're doing outside of this. But are you concerned with the way the world and the money is kind of taking a change?
Honestly, not anymore. Like, the more I study history, and I mentioned to you pre-recording, like, I've read over 90 books on personal finance, on investing, on economics, on history of empires rising and falling. And dude, there's just always something fucking happening. Like, you know, the world wars, they're like, that's it. And look, it was gnarly. Like, during, I'm pretty sure, like, you and I are very grateful we weren't around for World War One or World War Two. It must have sucked. Or for the Great Depression, sucked ass. But look what happened since then. It bounces back. Markets are resilient. And there's something called the efficient market hypothesis. And it just means all of these global events are priced in. My most recent example, let's use this. April of this year, Trump starts announcing tariffs. Okay? World goes into a fucking flat spin. The markets drop 25% within a week from its all-time highs. It's like the world is doomed. Trump is ruining everything. China's going to take over as the global superpower. Well, what did I do? I carried on every single month as if nothing happened. I invested the same amount. As a matter of fact, I actually invested more because the price dropped. So I was able to buy more of the same assets because it went on a discount. And since then, since April, we've hit 11 new all-time highs in the stock market. So what this is teaching me and learning more about history is shit happens all the time, but the world is designed to be resilient and flexible. And if there is some cataclysmic event that finally sends all of this into ground zero, then we have a lot more to worry about than just how much money we have in our fucking bank accounts. Then it's then our survival skills from the mountains come in handy.
You and I are up in the balance, away from everybody, because at that point you're in the show. Someone's like, "But this is how much Bitcoin I have," and he's like, "And it doesn't matter how much bread you have."
It's
true. And also, I think it gives you like the ability to have a bit of calm in the storm and understand that there are those rises and falls, and human nature is basically to overreact to situations for clicks and publicity and whatnot. But to be able to hold yourself and hold the discipline in your investments and the way you move your money to weather those storms and be diligent with that. Is that something you like to teach and tell to your clients and come ask you for, not advice, like for instruction or whatever?
Yeah, so that's a great point. And honestly, the best people always ask me when I do the coaching calls and they read my story and like what, where I'm now compared to where I started. There was like, what's the best decision you made? Or what's the best investment you made? What's the best crypto coin you bought? I'm like, none of that is applicable. The best decision I ever made was to automate my personal finances to the T. So what I mean by that, for someone that's such a big money nerd, and like literally I'm called the yachting investor, I only spend 15 minutes per month on my own finances. That's it. Because I've developed a system where I get my paycheck on the 26th of every month. On the 27th, I have a debit order going off of my bank accounts into my brokerage accounts, into my real estate accounts, into my savings accounts, into my crypto accounts. That happens without me doing anything. In each of those accounts, there's an automatic buy order when the cash lands in my US brokerage stock account. It buys the S&P 500 regardless of the price. So what that has done for me in the past 5-6 years is it's forced me to follow a structure and have a plan that I can't bail from, because it's actually a lot of effort for me to go and cancel all of these auto. I've made it pretty high friction so that I don't fuck with it. Then secondly, it's forced me to ignore the news. And a lot of the times, because I'm so involved with finance and investing, I'm always tuned in to some business podcast. I hear some announcement and I'm like, okay, the Federal Reserve is going to drop interest rates by 0.25% this week. Thus, the stocks are going to go up, so I should buy more this week. Then I'm like, why are you doing this? Like, rather spend your time and your energy to do fun stuff or go hang out with my fiance or my friends. So since I've done since I've built an automated system, I've ignored the news and I followed a trajectory of discipline. And that's what I predominantly help yachties with on my coaching programs, is to kind of first spend the first month seeing how much they spend, how much they are actually able to invest, and then to help, based on their nationality, to help them build a bulletproof plan on how can you link this bank account to this brokerage account. And before you know it, your automation is in play. And in 10, 15, 20 years, I know I'm going to get a message from these people saying, thank you very much. I retired at 45. My kids can go to college. And all I needed was automation and a plan.
Yep. And you got a nice kick-ass backyard that you're chilling in, drinking your beer, thinking, oh, thank God I listened to that man all those years ago.
That's the goal of all this, man. Like, it's not a rocket science. Nothing I've said today has been like, I didn't tell anyone to go and get a finance degree or learn how to read a company's earnings report. It's really easy, but it is a daunting topic, and a lot of people have a mental block against it. And traditional financial institutions have kind of groomed us in believing you need a professional to do it for you. You don't. The professionals don't beat the S&P 500. That is their benchmark. And 99% of financial advisors fail to outperform the benchmark. So why would you pay money to people who are performing worse than you just doing it yourself? It blows my mind.
And it saved you a whole bunch of fees and a whole bunch of money. Why don't you go and just some other guy to just so you can spend it somewhere else and do the exact same thing by the S&P 500? Well, I have to go here in a few minutes. Are there any final notes, any final tips where people can reach out to you, find you across all the social media channels, anything for our viewers?
So the easiest would be on Instagram at The Yachting Investor. I have a website called www.theyachtinginvestor.com. On there, you will find all my free resources, as well as courses, as well as the coaching program. And then I'm also the host of the Rich as Fuck podcast on the Yachting International radio channel. So yeah, you guys feel free to reach out. And thanks for having me, dude. It's good to see you again.
Yes, pleasure to catch up, brother. Been a minute. All right, Skeet, thank you, everybody, for watching. I'm your host, Alex Seegers from The Bridge. Welcome to my friend, Charles, here at The Yachting Investor. Just like to thank you for your time. And at the end of this, I'd like to say this now. Just everybody be kind to each other, be kind to your finances.